Russia announces nuclear drills after Western officials talk of deepening Ukraine involvement.
This latest announcement with actual drills to take place, of course, the risk is getting higher and escalation is getting also deeper.
Plus, Russian drone bombardments continued through the weekend as Orthodox Christians in Ukraine celebrated a third Easter Sunday at war.
People also marked the holiday in the war-struck town of Kostyantynivka, while knowing Russian troops are moving closer. I'm scared, but what can I do, says resident Svetlana. On Easter, I want to come here and get blessings.
And later in the program, writers increasingly at risk in Russia's escalating crackdown on any sort of dissent. Today is Monday, May 6th. From the Voice of America, this is Flashpoint Ukraine. Good evening, I'm Lori London. Russia said Monday it plans to hold drills simulating the use of battlefield nuclear weapons amid sharply rising tensions over comments by senior Western officials about possibly deeper involvement in the war in Ukraine. Anna Chernikova in Kyiv joins us now about this latest Kremlin announcement, which also followed a barrage of weekend Russian drone strikes as Ukrainians celebrated the Orthodox Easter holiday.
Has there been any reaction so far to this in Ukraine? And is there anything else you can add to what we're hearing?
At this moment of time, there is no official reaction yet from the Ukrainian authorities. It is expected that at least certain comments will be done later during the day. We will be following that. However, previously, Ukrainian officials already discussed this issue because it's not the first time that Russian Federation is using nuclear weapons and tactical nuclear weapons topic to demonstrate readiness for further escalation of the war in Ukraine and just to demonstrate certain strengths of the Russian forces for the Ukrainian allies as well. So in Ukraine, it is considered as definitely as something to be taken seriously. A lot of experts say that at this point, they do not see a realistic scenario that Russia actually will use this kind of weapons in Ukraine, but there are really high risks, and especially with this latest announcement with actual drills to take place, of course, the risk is getting higher and escalation is getting also deeper. In Ukraine, there is understanding that in case Russia decide to actually use nuclear weapons, even tactical nuclear weapons on the battlefield in Ukraine, Ukraine actually expects serious reaction from the allies and from the West because, as we all remember, Ukraine gave up its nuclear potential years ago, decades ago, and it is expected that Ukraine will get certain defense and security guarantees from the allies.
And also, it was a pretty intense weekend for Ukraine as it marked the third Easter at war. There was no let-up in Russian attacks. It sounds like there was a pretty intense barrage of drones concentrated on Ukraine's east.
Yeah, another Easter in Ukraine in the situation of full-scale invasion and another Easter that Ukrainians did expect certain intensifying of the shelling. Both drones and missile attacks were expected, and this is actually what happened. There were confirmations of attacks in different regions of Ukraine, so mainly Sumy, which is in the north part of the country, Kharkiv and Dnipro, which is east, and Odessa, which is in the south. Most of the attacks were targeting either civilian infrastructure or critical infrastructure, and if we're talking about Dnipro, for instance, high voltage lines were damaged. Also in Sumy, energy infrastructure was damaged. In Kharkiv, there are also reports of critical infrastructure and civilian area under attack. Even one of the attacks was targeting a very central part of the city, and at least 20 residential buildings were affected. And also in Odessa, critical infrastructure of the port infrastructure was under attack. So quite tough weekend for Ukraine amid the Easter time, and of course, a lot of Ukrainians were trying to spend this time with their families, but again, under quite a high and intensive shelling from the Russian forces.
Anna Chernikova reporting for VOA from Kyiv. Thank you so much.
Thank you, Laurie.
Besides announcing plans to conduct nuclear drills, Russia Monday also summoned the British ambassador to the foreign ministry and warned that Ukrainian attacks on Russian territory with UK-supplied weapons could could bring retaliatory strikes against British military facilities and equipment on Ukrainian soil or elsewhere. Ukrainians flocked to church on Sunday to mark the third wartime Easter as Russian troops inched closer to threatening some of the region's key cities. Angela Johnston with Reuters reports.
In Ukraine's embattled east, Chaplain Yevhen Savchenko is with the military's 93rd Mechanized Brigade. And on Sunday, he helped visibly tired troops at a temporary base in an undisclosed location mark the Orthodox Easter holiday. So many people can go to church and be at their homes in peace and freedom, he says, thanking the soldiers. This is the third wartime Easter commemoration since Russian forces invaded Ukraine. These soldiers only gave their first names. Yuri says he can't help but think of loved ones back home.
How do I feel? I want this war to be over as soon as possible, go home to my family and celebrate Easter with them, or with my comrades, but in a different setting.
In the absence of family, these soldiers enjoy traditional Easter pastries provided by acquaintances and volunteers. While most Western churches observed the Easter holiday at the end of March, Orthodox Christians, including those in Ukraine and Russia, mark it now. Fighting on the Eastern Front has worsened in recent weeks, particularly around the town of Chasiv Yar, all while Ukrainian troops wait for crucial U.S. military aid to beat back Moscow's advance. Meanwhile, several airstrikes hit the eastern city of Kharkiv on Sunday, leaving a woman dead and more than a dozen injured. In Kyiv, a local cathedral and folklore museum teamed up to honor the army's fight. President Volodymyr Zelensky called on Ukrainians to unite in prayer. People also marked the holiday in the war-struck town of Kostyantynivka, while knowing Russian troops are moving closer. I'm scared, but what can I do? Says resident Svetlana. On Easter, I want to come here and get blessings for my Easter cake and eggs. Despite everything, it's a holiday.
Angela Johnston with Reuters reporting. Vladimir Putin begins his fifth term as Russian president Tuesday in an expected opulent Kremlin inauguration after destroying his political opposition, launching a devastating military operation in Ukraine, and concentrating all power in his hands. Associated Press correspondent Emma Burrows lays it out for us.
Vladimir Putin will likely be applauded as he strides down the opulent corridors of the Grand Kremlin Palace on the way to his inauguration for his fifth presidential term, which could see him become the longest ruling Russian leader since Joseph Stalin, putting him in the Kremlin until 2030, when he's in his late 70s. Officials said he won the election in March by a landslide, but his victory was never really in doubt. Since Putin sent his troops into Ukraine more than 2 years ago, Russian authorities have cracked down on dissent, and there was no real opposition standing against him. The question now is what Putin's going to do with another 6 years in power. There's concern authorities could hike taxes to fund the fighting in Ukraine, draft more soldiers, and some European officials have even warned that Russia could attack a NATO country. There was no suspense around Putin's re-election, but there is anxiety about what comes next.
That was AP correspondent Emma Burrows. You're listening to VOA's Flashpoint Ukraine. I'm Lori London. Been a significant rise in the number of arrests of journalists, writers, and independent thinkers across the globe. That, according to PEN America's just-released annual Freedom to Write Index 2023, and it indicates Russia's crackdown on dissent since its invasion of Ukraine has led to a substantial increase in the number of writers being jailed. I spoke with Polina Sadovskaya, PEN America Program Director for Advocacy and Eurasia.
Wars and conflicts always have a strong impact on writers and freedom of expression. And last year, there was certainly no shortage of wars. And for the first time, Russia and Israel also entered top 10 countries, jailers of writers. Russia has been just previously very smart about their persecution of the free speech. And it seems like the more war with Ukraine goes into force, the less barriers for Russia exist. So I would say that that is part of the reason why we see such an increase. And since the start of Russia's full-scale invasion of Ukraine in 2022, Russia has significantly stepped up its attack on writers and now shares the sixth place in the index with Belarus. In 2023 in Russia, 16 people of the world were captured and detained for more than 48 hours, of which 11 detained and imprisoned for anti-war statements. So see, there is a clear link to the Russian full-scale invasion of Ukraine.
We've got one of our own colleagues here, Radio Free Europe journalist, Alsu Kurmasheva, who's a dual citizen. We've got Wall Street Journal reporter Evan Gershkovich. And now we're hearing two Russian journalists that were Reuters and AP contributors or were detained and imprisoned for what is being called an extremist organization. This seems to be really ramping up in a more bold way. And, you know, we've just never really seen something like this in Russia, like journalists being.
I agree with you. And even though we do not count the journalists and cameramen and those who work for newsroom in the index, but Alsu Kurmasheva, who you mentioned, who worked for RFERL, she also is an editor of the book that is a book of testimonies of Russians who express anti-war sentiment. And because of that, she got into our index, and she's one of the 16 people from the Russia case. It is, I think, also important to mention that Alsu, unlike Ivan, has not yet received the status of the wrongly detained by the U.S. government. And I would certainly use this opportunity to say that this is something that needs to be done so that Alsu, together with Ivan, would be like in the same position. It will certainly help us in our advocacy on her behalf.
My understanding is from your report that this has been happening with all sorts of writers in Russia, from not just books, from playwrights, poets.
Absolutely. So among the 16 writers that we listed in the index, there are writers of various genres, poets such as Artem Kamardin, playwrights and screenwriters like Zhenya Berkovich and Svetlana Petrichuk, authors of illustrated books like Sasha Skochilenko. You know, we see that writers are the ones who help people to imagine better life, better future for themselves, freer future with more freedoms. And that is why they are targeted by authoritarian regimes. And that is why they pay this price. So definitely the more different creative means they use, the more they can spike the imagination of people. And that's what governments do not want. Authoritarian governments do not want.
And you yourself are Russian, and I understand that you've done some writing and some journalism yourself. Would that prohibit you from potentially being a target if you were to go back?
I would say that definitely Russia is not the country, the environment for the independent journalists at the moment. So I am a Russian-American citizen, so I have dual passports, such as Alsu Kurmasheva. Not sure about even whether he has a Russian passport or not, but he is an American citizen. And yet this did not save neither Alsu nor even from prison. So yes, it is a very dangerous environment for the independent thought right now. We also note a major increase in the number of women writers jailed, and specifically in Russia and Iran. In Russia, we link this trend to the effects of many men leaving the country just not to join the army, yet the government didn't plan to slow down repressions, and that's why we see this is happening. And international mechanisms are needed urgently to protect writers at risk, because more and more writers are not as prepared as journalists to this.
And I'm sure that must be difficult for you, having a originally from there, it must be a painful thing to see happening to your heritage and your culture.
Absolutely, yes, of course. I can say that when I left Russia, it wasn't with the thought that I will never be able to come back. And I still hope that it's not never, but at the moment, I would definitely be cautious about going back.
Thank you so much for taking the time. We appreciate it.
Thank you.
Polina Sadovskaya, Program Director for Advocacy and Eurasia. The number of Russian soldiers killed in combat since the beginning of the full-scale invasion of Ukraine remains a secret that the Kremlin goes to great lengths to hide. However, open-source research has recently yielded figures that show Moscow's losses have been heavy. Elizabeth Chernev narrates this report by Ricardo Marquina.
A memorial ceremony is held by occupation officials in Crimea for Russian soldiers killed in action. Ceremonies like this, as well as public information derived from obituaries in the local media, give independent sources like the opposition media outlet Mediazona precious tidbits of information. Those added up to a figure of 50,000 Russian soldiers killed in action during these 2 years of war. Their investigation was based on open-source intelligence with the hope of shedding light on facts the Kremlin has kept hidden, at least among the sources it can control. Arno Reusser founded the open-source intelligence branch of the Dutch Defense Intelligence and Security Service and now heads an open-source consultancy.
You need to know which open sources are very difficult to influence by any state. So new graveyards is something that you can't deny. If you make satellite imagery of new graveyards that weren't there a year ago, that's pretty objective, isn't it?
Some observers believe the figures this research has yielded are much lower than the real ones. Russian society, they say, no longer uses social networks to talk about political or military issues as freely as they did a decade ago. Access to information is much more limited now than it was in 2014. This is the opinion of the Russian analyst Pavel Lusin, a visiting scholar at Tufts University's Fletcher School of Law and Diplomacy in the U.S. state of Massachusetts. He says that 10 years ago, people in Russia were more open. There were many fewer people who kept their pages closed and not accessible to outsiders. He says it was possible to open the page of practically anyone and see what kind of life he or she led. Kyiv, for its part, has given an official death toll, although that too is questioned by some. President Volodymyr Zelensky in February said 31,000 Ukrainian soldiers have died since the start of the full-scale invasion, but that figure has also not been verified. Russia's tactics have been dubbed by some as equivalent to a, quote, meat grinder, unquote. Despite mounting evidence of extremely high casualties, they see no sign that Moscow will change the way it is fighting the war. Keir Giles, a senior consulting fellow in the Russia and Eurasia program at Chatham House, explains.
In Russia's tactics of assault, we've seen over and over again that just throwing bodies into the firing line counts as valid tactics as far as Russia is concerned.
Russia shows no intention of clearing the fog of disinformation on its casualty figures or on the realities that its soldiers are living in the battlefields of Ukraine. For Ricardo Marquina, Elizabeth Chernev, VOA News.
After 2 years of Russia's full-scale invasion, officials say Ukraine is one of the most mined countries in the world, as Bakalets reports from Kyiv. Besides threatening human lives, the mines are also impacting the environment.
The village of Lipivka in the Kyiv region was occupied by Russians at the beginning of the full-scale invasion. The signs indicate there is a minefield they left 300 meters from here. Mine clearing charity the Halo Trust is working to clear it. Deminer Yulia doesn't give her last name for security reasons. She says she moves her hand forward very carefully. If she sees something that looks like a tripwire, she rubs it with her fingers. The one she is looking at now is a dry stalk of grass. She fills it with her fingers, she says. The Kyiv region is one of three areas in Ukraine where the Halo Trust is working to clear landmines and other explosives. Sam Rowlands is an operations officer with the group in Ukraine.
With the conflict ongoing and the scale of contamination, it's hard to say precisely, but it's likely that Ukraine is the most contaminated country in the world. So estimates for how long it will take to demine Ukraine range from 10 years to more.
Ukraine's environment minister Ruslan Strelets explains the scale of the issue. He says 25% of Ukraine's territory is mined or potentially requires study and future demining. Apart from the mortal danger for people, mines also cause significant damage to the environment, said the minister. Each uncontrolled explosion can cause a forest fire. Strelets says firefighters cannot even get access to some areas due to the mining. They've had cases where foresters received information that a fire was starting and were killed by mines while trying to reach it. Explosives also kill animals who cannot be stopped by warning signs. Every explosion, even a controlled one during demining, means heavy metals seep into the soil. Maria Dechuk is an expert at the Center for Environmental Initiatives, EcoAction. She says it is important to record the level of pollution after demining. This impact on the environment is currently not being tracked, but that should change, so the level of pollution is taken into account when the land is returned for use, she adds. That is a goal the Halo Trust is working towards with its agricultural team.
They have started conversations with national universities and other actors in Ukraine to see if it's possible for us to start conducting soil analysis from areas where we know there have either been explosions or heavy metal contamination from artillery and other weapons used in fighting.
Environment Minister Strelets says Ukraine's ecosystems represent 30% of the entire biodiversity of Europe. He says demining is the first step in healing the damage.
And finally today, a U.S. architect is helping to design and renovate housing for internally displaced Ukrainians. VOA's Tatiana Kukurica met with the architect. Anna Rice narrates the story.
33-year-old American Michael Bem is an architect. He arrived in Ukraine in January 2023 to volunteer with the charity group Ukraine Relief Effort. He says despite the dangers, his family and friends support him.
My older brother had a tour in Iraq and Afghanistan as a medic in the U.S. Army, and my little brother is a woodland firefighter, so this is the least dangerous thing that her children has done.
Bem helps design and renovate housing for internally displaced Ukrainians. He replaces windows and doors, installs plumbing and insulation, and builds showers and kitchens. He worked in Ukraine's Ternopil region before arriving here, a small community in the Khmelnytsky region. Tatiana Krivoruchka is the Zhvanetska village administrator.
Almost all the private homes here also had internally displaced people living in them. We did what we could to give them personal space to make sure they're not crammed in dorms, in kindergarten or school buildings, but rather in houses.
Michael Bem works with internally displaced Ukrainians like Chichvarova.
We showed Michael how we washed ourselves, how we would prepare basins and buckets of water, pans and pots with hot water. He was horrified. He said, I would never want my mother to live in such conditions. I'll do what I can to make your lives better.
Chichvarova and Alena Muravenko arrived here from Kramatorsk in March of 2022 after Russia's full-scale invasion of Ukraine. Alena Chichvarova, internally displaced.
Back then, we were happy to agree to anything. We thought it would be a month or two, not more than that. Well, here we are. The toilet is outside, so is the shower, the kitchen, and the washing machine.
We find the situation that they're living in, and we find out what they do have. For instance, here, they have a shelter. They have heating, they have lockable doors, so those are good things, and they just need a few extra things to be living in a nice condition.
This house in the village of Sokel is the first where Michael does all the work himself. Previously, he would get help from local contractors. The Ukraine Relief Effort, which helps fund the projects, is supported by donations. Bem says he plans to continue to volunteer.
I grew up very poor, and there were many people that helped my family, And I think I just grew up with an extreme appreciation for helping people in need.
Bem says he plans to stay in Ukraine after the war is over to help rebuild the country. For Tatiana Kukurika in Khmelnytsky, Ukraine, NRI's VOA News.
And that will do it for us today. On behalf of all of us here at VOA, thank you so much for listening. Until next time, I'm Lori London.